Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Behavioral Health Integration episode. Today, I have the distinct pleasure of having Sam and Steven Mandel on the show today. They are out of Los Angeles, California. They both represent Ketamine Clinics Los Angeles. And Sam Mandel is the Ketamine Clinics co-founder and COO and a mental health and psychedelic medicine advocate. Sam started the Ketamine Clinics Los Angeles with his father, Dr. Steven Mandel, in 2014 and has grown the clinic to be one of the most successful and well-respected ketamine infusion therapy clinics in the United States. Dr. Steven Mandel is an internationally recognized expert and pioneer in the use of ketamine infusion therapy to treat mental health disorders and chronic pain. Dr. Steven is an internationally recognized expert and pioneer in the use of ketamine infusion therapy to treat mental health disorders and chronic pain. Dr. Steven Mandel has over 40 years of experience utilizing ketamine as a board-certified anesthesiologist. I, for one, am truly excited to have these two professionals on my show today as they discuss their thoughts on ketamine-assisted therapy, where they feel ketamine therapy is going in the future as it comes to treating different types of mental health disorders, and so much more. So without further ado, let's get started. Well, again, Sam and Steven, thank you so much for being on the show. It is a great pleasure to have you both on.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Jacob.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I'm starting to get into a little theme. I've been doing a lot of ketamine episodes, and now I'm starting to get to a West Coast theme because the last guy I was on was from California, and you guys are from California. And actually, what part of California are you guys from?
Los Angeles.
Oh, nice, nice. So I'm sure it's just beautiful there right now.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. We're okay here in Minnesota, but it's starting to get cold.
Yes.
So one thing that just really intrigued me with your guys' business and everything is just how did it really get started? Because I know you have the family dynamic and everything. Can you elaborate a little bit? Because it just sounds like a fascinating story.
How ketamine got started or how we got started?
How you two got started.
Do you mind if I start, Sam?
No, please go ahead.
I'm a physician. Mm-hmm. I'm a board certified anesthesiologist. I was doing anesthesia quite voluminously in the Los Angeles basin. Surgery had migrated from inpatient to outpatient during the time of my career, and by the early 2000s, most surgery was outpatient. I had a very busy mobile anesthesia practice. And because it was mobile, I wasn't using a lot of anesthesia machines. I was using infusions, propofol and ketamine and other things. So I was a bit of an artist at using these agents to provide anesthesia.
Okay.
I'd also been to graduate school in clinical psychology.
Really?
Everything short of my PhD in clinical psychology before I started medical school.
When did you go to psychology school, by the way?
65 to 69.
Because back then, I think you could have got your licensed psychologist or degree with a master's or less then.
Well, I got my master's, but at that time, licensure wasn't really something psychologists did.
Okay.
They get their PhDs and they offer therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Often they did research, often they did academic work, teaching, and often they did clinical work. I did a clinical track, and I was doing psychotherapy. I ended up going to medical school.
Wow.
And coming out and doing anesthesia. But because I had this mobile practice, I was very tuned into infusions.
Yeah.
And because I had a real interest in psychology, particularly in mood disorders,
uh-huh.
I stayed tuned to what was going on. So when we started hearing in the early 2000s that ketamine, which was an agent, an anesthetic approved by the FDA as an anesthetic in 1970, was being used now for mood disorders, something dear to my heart, about which we had nothing effective.
Yeah.
You know, the SSRIs had come out in the late 80s, and they were really marginally effective. I shouldn't say that. It will offend some people. They
left many
patients unsatisfied.
Let's call it what it is, you know.
In any event, when ketamine turned out to really remove mood in hours to days instead of weeks to months, and when it turned out to do it 70% of the time instead of 50 or 45, and when it did it without any loss of libido and without any obesity, I was really turned on.
Because those are the most two popular side effects, right, for a lot of medications is obesity.
I wouldn't call them popular,
Jacob. Or the highest percentage of, yeah.
They're common.
More common.
Yes.
More
yes.
Common. Yeah.
They're popular.
Yeah, I mean, just to add, when you talk about, these medicines, I mean, they have their place and, you know, they have helped a lot of people and helped to stabilize a lot of people. So they have been a good, you know, advancement for society and for mental health. Uh-huh. They are far from adequate in a lot of ways. I mean, there's, it can be both these conflicting truths can both coexist, right? And I think it's important to openly discuss both of them, you know. Mm-hmm. About 30 to 35% of the patients who try all these medications don't respond to them at all.
Yeah.
The rest have often a pretty mediocre level of relief. So when, you know, we often think of relief as a black or white thing, all or nothing, it works or it doesn't, but that's not reality. There's it's a scale. And many people will report being able to get out of bed and go to work after taking a prescription SSRI, but feeling pretty flat and numb, kind of like a shell of themselves and not happy. So is it good that, you know, John could get out of bed and go to work? Of course. And if he wasn't doing it before, absolutely. That's something to celebrate, no question. But is John really living a good life? Is he thriving? Is that really where we should stop in our effort to help him to be the best person he can be and enjoy his life? No, it's far from it. You know, and it often is a stopping point for a lot of people on those medications, in addition to the side effects. And then, you know, usually after a year or two, there needs to be some significant changes in the medication regime, or they don't really work as well as they did. Mm-hmm. But without getting too far into that, just to take it back to your question, as far as how did we start? We started in 2014, the two of us, when we became aware of the breakthroughs with ketamine in the early research.
Well, Sam, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you ever want to get into the medical field, or were you always like business mindset? Like,
no, yeah. I can't say I ever really did want to be a clinician. I'll tell you, not at all the same thing, but I wanted to be a veterinarian when I was a kid.
Okay, nice.
And then I realized that it meant dealing with sick and injured animals, and that idea made me sad. And it was not what I wanted.
And at 14, he volunteered in a suicide hotline for teens for years and was very good at it.
Oh, wow.
So he has a clinical inclination.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I speak with a lot of doctors in what I do, and obviously. Mm-hmm. Of a doctor, I think that I really enjoy and appreciate clinical care very much. I think it's definitely lent that interest, curiosity, that passion has lent itself to us being successful in what we do. But no, I didn't. It's not like when I was a kid, I, you know, wanted to be a doctor when I grew up or anything like that. I did do Teen Line, which is, you know, teen to teen suicide prevention hotline, and.
Okay.
I got a lot of value from that. And I think I just naturally was inclined to want to help people. I think that's definitely something that I've really had at the core of everything that I've done and wanted to do is to make an impact. And just because of, you know, things I've been through and friends and family, struggles that they've had, I've felt comfortable in this mental health space and addiction space. And like I could understand, you know, where people were at, what they were going through.
Okay. I have a question. Do you guys have therapists at your clinic too?
We have tremendous advocacy for therapy.
Okay.
We have a whole program of adjunctive interventions that enhance and extend the benefits of ketamine. We don't have therapists in our clinic.
Okay.
And I think it really might be interesting to your listeners to take a closer look at that, because some people say, well, you know, why don't you offer therapy? Isn't that important? I heard of somebody who's giving therapy with the ketamine. Isn't that better? Well, let's take a close look at that.
Yeah.
Ketamine by itself is very effective, but leaves something to be desired for many people. And therapy by itself is very effective, but does leave something to be desired for many people. Mm-hmm. The combination seems like a natural. Let's do both of them. Let's do both of them. But when you look really closely, doing both of them at the same time really doesn't work. It's like, I'm sorry, but it's like Lucy's Vegematic. It does everything, but it doesn't do anything great.
Mm-hmm.
Because to give enough ketamine to get the transformation that we want to get reliably, it needs to be given intravenously, and it needs to be given in relatively high dose. Not super high dose, but higher dose than the typical recipient can sustain and also be able to have a meaningful dialogue with another human being at that time.
Yep.
So the skilled therapist is left offering a safety net, being a kind of a sitter,
mm-hmm.
a kind of a supporter for a journey for much of that time, if you go to the doses that we advocate.
Yeah.
Very shortly thereafter, the patient regains full executive authority over their cognitive functions. And then they're super opened up and they're really, really primed to do therapy. And many meaningful breakthroughs occur during that peri-infusion period. Under the influence of a good therapist.
Mm-hmm. Every doctor, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
No, you're right. Every ketamine physician, and when I say ketamine physician, I do find it more anesthesiologists are more interested in ketamine. Obviously, some ER doctors too. And I guess you don't need a certain specialty to get into ketamine. Is it right? Is that correct? Well, yeah.
Certain level of licensure as far as like your scope of practice in order to have a DEA license and to use ketamine in this way, but I think pretty much any physician can.
Yeah, and they always advocate for therapy, but you're right, they never do it while the person's getting the dose. It's always post dose, like you just mentioned. But I think there is some common misconfusion because psychedelics are now just starting to get really popular. When it comes to, let's say, like ayahuasca, MDMA, stuff like that, where there's a lot of clinics that actually do therapy during like the dosage as it's giving, and they have been known to have positive effects from that. But again, that's that substance, right. That's not ketamine. So,
well, each of the
Jacob, as Sam said before, it's not an all or none thing.
Mm-hmm.
All of these approaches produce positive effects. Some of the time.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking to optimize here. But I've been around with the ayahuasca crowd and the high-dose psilocybin crowd.
Yep.
And, you know, during the peak of that experience, there's no meaningful dialogue going on.
Okay.
It's all adjectives and adverbs. It's all experiential. It's outside language. Therapy occurs in language. Therapy's cognitive processing of non-cognitive experiences.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, also all these psychedelics are, you know, often grouped together, and they're not, they're all quite unique from one another. And while they can provide a certain level of access to inner work and to self-reflection and insight and healing, and can disarm patients and help them to access material that otherwise they've buried away quite deeply, they all also are quite unique from one another and operate in a very different way. MDMA, psilocybin, ketamine, ayahuasca, you name it, LSD. I mean, they all have quite unique properties to them, a way they the brain and also experientially. So it's also a little bit of a disservice to just kind of lump them all into one category. But only something that they do have as a commonality, as Dr. Mandel is saying, is when people are having that experience, it's extremely uncommon for them to be able to have any kind of meaningful dialogue during it.
Interesting.
I've done with prep and integration work, with helping people to go into those experiences with clear intention and outline some safety features and whatnot of the experience. And then, of course, a sitter or someone who can help to keep them safe during it. And then afterwards, to help them to process and make sense of the experience. But as far as actual therapy that's co-occurring, you know, I don't think you'll see a lot of that. As much as people like to talk about it, focus on it, advocate for it, the reality, from what we see, there's not a lot of meaningful work in that area actually being done.
Yep.
And I do see a lot of practitioners who are doing ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, who are giving less than optimum doses of ketamine so that the patient can maintain good contact during the session. And incidentally, because the higher doses sometimes make the therapist uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's also this very different approaches here, right? Because you can give us a low dose of ketamine to help somebody to, you know, with talk therapy and have some great breakthroughs. And that might have been more about the ketamine supporting the therapy than any independent benefit the ketamine itself was providing on its own, except to just simply be a tool to facilitate therapy, which is great. Absolutely nothing wrong with that at all. I just think there's a lot of nuance here, and we tend to talk about these things in broader strokes.
Okay. So then I actually have a really good question. After the post dosage and they come down, the therapist would usually see them maybe a couple of days after, or what would you recommend? Because you make perfect sense where, yeah, even as a therapist, now that I'm starting to think about it, if they can't have like adequate dialogue with one another, then what good is it? So yeah, and again, I've never actually gone through any of these experiences before, but like you said, it makes a lot of sense.
Okay, so picture it. You're going to be on a journey. You're going to get to a very high hill. Yeah. And then you're going to come down to flat ground. On flat ground, you're about as resistant to therapy as you ever were.
Okay.
On the high hill, you're very open, but you can't do cognitive processing.
Yeah.
So somewhere on that descent, you want to really get in contact and intervene. Now, the research as to the kinetics of that are not really well worked out.
Mm-hmm.
It's our judgment and our experience from thousands of, literally many thousands, over 15,000 infusions over 8 years, that varies a lot with the experience of the patient. In your first infusion, it's the hill's pretty steep, from being very open to being closed up again. And after a handful of infusions, people stay open for many days, sometimes weeks, if they use adjuncts like continuing therapy, like mindfulness, they can stay open even longer.
Yep.
But eventually, usually, the way we're wired and what we're buffeted by in our world today, we need a booster, because we start to close off again and our parts starts to isolate from one another again. And our default mode network starts to bully us again. Whatever your favorite model is, the pathologies, the encumbrances of modern life, in truth, this is not a cure. It's a treatment.
Mm-hmm. You know, Stephen, I'm kind of curious, what does the research say, or maybe Sam, you can help me out too, regarding ketamine versus, let's say, like antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications when it comes to positive effects?
Well, there's lots of research about ketamine, and there's lots of research about traditional antidepressants like SSRIs, SNRIs, and a tiny bit of research when the atypicals and antipsychotics, the mood elevators, are used as adjuvants to the SSRIs and SNRIs, which are the mainstays of the treatment of depression, both treatment-resistant and bipolar. However, there are virtually no head-to-head studies of ketamine or any other agent versus an SSRI.
Why not?
And there are almost no head-to-head studies of one SSRI with another. And it's very carefully arranged that those don't get funded.
Why?
Or don't get approved.
Conspiracy theory?
No, I'm not paranoid. Who would pay to jeopardize their own market?
Right.
You know what? One thing about these studies that you may or may
not conspiracy, self-preservation,
is that the average cost of these studies is, you know, tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of dollars. And so there needs to be a ROI on it. And when you have a cheap generic drug that's or in all clinical research is indicated that it works faster, better, and safer than the alternatives. And you have alternatives that have a really relatively few number of companies who stand to make or lose a lot of money with. Who wants to play that game, you know?
Mm.
There's no one in the ketamine corner who can advocate for it with anything close to the level of resources that the others can, because no one makes money with the sale of ketamine. It's a cheap generic drug. So there's a spokesperson, so to speak.
But I will tell you this. There are lots of studies of ketamine, and there are lots of studies of SSRIs with similar designs and similar outcome measures.
Yeah.
So we know on the Beck Depression Inventory index. We know on the MADRS. We know on the GAD-7. We know on the PHQ-9. We know what these are were going in for the better studies, what they are during, what they are coming out. And those studies include as their independent variable is what they give the patient. Ketamine and SSRIs and SNRIs and various combinations. So we can look. And we also have patient reports, which although some people don't like them because they're hard to quantify and they're hard to put in tables and charts, they are the gold standard.
Mm-hmm.
How did you used to feel? How do you feel now?
Yep.
How often did you used to go to work? Mm. How often are you going to work now? How often did you used to drink? How often did you used to shoot up? How often did you used to come in late because you were hungover?
Yep. You know, this is about part of the quality of relief question that we kind of started out on, you know, and that's most patients, I would say almost all patients of ketamine would say that the quality of relief is just unlike anything they've experienced before, you know, that they are actually really feeling good, that they haven't felt this great since they were a child or in years. You know, people say things like this all the time. They report feeling the best they've ever felt, literally. And I'm not just talking about, and you know, the naysayers will go, yeah, they're high on ketamine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about during their infusion or a few minutes afterwards. I'm talking about in the weeks and months to follow. This is the quality of life that these people mm-hmm. are seeing day in and day out, not a fluke for 5 minutes or one time or while they're under the influence.
Yeah.
We're talking about lasting results here. And it's significant.
Not only all those metrics of better functionality, I'm feeling pleasure. And their significant others say things like, he's telling jokes.
Yeah.
He got down on the floor and he played with the kids after dinner. He hasn't done that in months.
Man, just hearing those stories, it has to give you so much joy as a practitioner. It's just...
That's why I do it.
that's what keeps us going for sure. You know, it's hard work this way. It really is, you know. I think a lot of the, you know, we kind of started out, I think before we were recording, we were talking just a little bit about kind of like the business landscape and just clinical. And yeah, I think there's a lot of people entering the space as it's growing and becoming more popular who don't have a connection to those results or don't value those results. And I think it shows in some of the moves they're making and the results that they're getting in terms of their, you know, success or lack thereof. And, you know, this is stuff that matters to us.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious. Again, obviously HIPAA, so you can't give you too much patient information, but do you guys get a lot of substance users, like alcohol users, meth users?
Absolutely. It's not a HIPAA violation at all. We get many opiate people while they're using, and particularly chippers, and in their early abstinence saying, I heard that this can help me to stay off. I want your help.
Okay.
We also get a lot of people with alcohol use, with what the psychiatrists call alcohol use disorder.
Mm.
People who start their happy hour right after the alarm clock goes off.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them are quite functional, but they're dangerous to themselves and others, and they're miserable. And they come for help. We also have a number of people who are on SSRIs and SNRIs who are no longer working as well. And although they're functional, they feel locked in. They feel zombified.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have enthusiasm. They don't have libido. They don't have a sense of purpose. Sometimes they're getting a little suicidal again, despite the SSRI. And they want help in either supplementing those or transitioning off of them. Okay. And they too come to us.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of people know ketamine is Special K, which is, you know, a drug that people use on the street, and whether you want to call it self-medicating or recreational use or whatever label you want to put on it, it exists. It's not, I think, as common as some people like to make it out to be. And there's some really important differences between the street use population and the way that we use it in the clinic, even if it's, quote, the same drug.
Yeah.
It's really not in a lot of ways. But people are surprised that a drug of abuse could also be a drug to help people who are abusing drugs. I understand that from the outside looking in, it might sound a little bit strange, but the reality is ketamine used clinically actually can be very, very helpful at helping to curb cravings.
Do you honestly think, though, that may be one of the biggest barriers ketamine has when it comes to, like, getting to higher levels of, like, more facilities, providing more care, is just that thought, like, oh, a drug user using drugs?
Because
there's a lot of old school, like...
Yeah, I think so.
But, Jacob, it's not the medication. It's the education and the public relations.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's interesting first and foremost is to take a step back and recognize that in reality, a lot of people, I would venture to maybe even say most people who are using drugs on the street are self-medicated.
Mm-hmm.
And then it becomes a little less weird when you start to understand that and make the connection that people are suffering. People have trauma, depression, and anxiety, and hopelessness and feelings of worthlessness that they're looking to numb. And they're turning to substances. Most common one in this world is alcohol. There's a lot of different flavors out there. But at the end of the day, people are suffering and they're using substances to cope with that. So it's actually not that weird that you would think that one of those that people use is actually something that can be helpful when it's used in the right context. There's definitely stigma around, you know, ketamine. And that's something that we have to overcome. And as Dr. Mandel said, that really is more of, and stigma because of this. And that's really an educational gap more than anything.
And when I say, I'm thinking of more, like, nothing against, like, 12 steps, NA, but I've met a lot of those, like, individuals who are, again, are against stuff like this because they still have that old style of mentality of sobriety and so forth. So that's why I bring it up.
But actually, Derek, the Central Committee and the people higher up in AA think this and other drugs used to facilitate people abstinence is a good thing. And in fact, one of the, was it Dr. Silkwood or was it? I'm sorry. One of the founders of AA. Dr. Bill.
Yeah.
Bill Wilson.
The surgeon, yep.
Bill Wilson dabbled extensively in the use of LSD for therapeutic purposes.
So,
and was
yeah.
a strong advocate and, in fact, had a big yep. fight with another faction in L.A., yep. In AA, because yeah. he wanted to go public with that advocacy. And he was silenced.
Yes.
This is the guy who wrote the big book.
There are so many.
And the Central Committee today says these adjuvants are fine. So the old liners that say, oh, no, that goes against AA, that's a failure to understand.
There are so many AA and NAers will even argue that, no, Bill was never on LSD. That moment in time is like, I agree with you, though. I agree that that did happen 110%. But there's yeah. so many out there that will deny that to their grave.
Well, yes, I know, and some people think somebody didn't win the election, too. We can't deal yeah. with lies, you know?
Yep. I mean...
truth is the truth.
You yep. have to also take a step back and look at what you're going to do here. You know, AA is about not using alcohol and drugs, right, in your daily living to be your best self, right? I mean, in yeah. an actual, I mean... And is you getting a clinical treatment from a doctor in a doctor's office, which can help you to have long-term longevity in your health and your wellness, the same thing as getting high on your own or numbing or avoiding yeah. or substances. They're just totally not, it's not apples to apples. It's hard to see how that's justified just because it's a drug that it's bad and wrong mm-hmm. and you're able to be strong enough with the program enough that you can do life without it. I mean, mm-hmm. it just seems a little silly to me.
Absolutely. Yep. Oh, I agree 110% too. Yeah. And actually, I have a curiosity, like, do you have people who would come in, we'll just use alcohol as an example, right? We'll be like, hey, you know, I don't want to be like fully abstinent, but can I take a harm reduction approach with you guys? And maybe ketamine can help me become that person that uses me once or twice a week rather than I used to drink every day. I mean, do you get a lot of that at times?
We do. We're very interested in helping people. We're very interested in bridging very perilous journeys across big chasms, but we're not interested in being enablers. Part of the story and the excuse.
Okay.
And sometimes it's really hard to tease that out, and sometimes you have to be very patient, because what we're asking people to do for their own good really is very difficult, and we should never get blind to the fact that the words just roll off our tongues. Mm-hmm. But for those with cravings, if anybody's ever had a craving,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's a big ask.
Yes.
So we have to be patient, and we have to be compassionate, yeah. but not indulgent. Mm-hmm. And that's a tough line to follow.
Yeah.
But we do work with addiction psychiatrists and with various centers in the community, and we don't feel that this is really a good fit for 9 out of 10 people as a standalone. You know, it's not like just have infusions and then the addiction issue is fine. It, you know, this is a tool to really help with the underlying issues, curb cravings. You know, a lot of the reasons why we touched on this earlier, people are using is to deal with depression, anxiety, PTSD. So, you know, ketamine's not just good at curbing cravings, but also helping people to process and heal from those underlying drivers, you know, that are pushing people towards the desire to use substances. So it can really help with healing. They need therapy, they need program, they need support, you know, depending on what their drug of choice is. They might need detox. They might, you know, there's so many different levels of addiction. So this is just a really great tool to be incorporated into a bigger treatment program.
It's really what Sam said is so important. This is not a standalone. This is not a do it this way or some other way. This is let's use the best of all that works. And this works better with a therapist. And it works better with good nutrition.
Yeah.
And nothing works well without good sleep hygiene, however you get it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a trainer, if you have an intimate interpersonal relationship with a peer, all of those things give you more mileage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jacob, so, this has been awesome chatting with you today. I want to, of course, be mindful of your
yes
in your show.
Yeah. Oh man, I got so much. I mean, I would love to have you guys on again, man. Like, I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, this is great. Yeah, we'd love to come back.
Absolutely.
Obviously, anyone listening wants to learn more. I mean, we have a lot of great information on our website. It's ketamineclinics.com. It's just KETAMINE. And then clinics, CLINICS.com. And lots of good info there. And the people who pick up the phone around here are really compassionate and knowledgeable too. And they're always happy to answer questions.
Absolutely. Thank you, gentlemen. Much appreciated.
Yeah. Thank you, Jacob.
Thank you, Jacob.
I again want to thank Sam and Steven for another awesome and amazing behavior health integration episode. I also want to thank all of my listeners for supporting me. It truly means a lot. And I just want to inform everyone that the information expressed on this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a licensed medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. I also want to inform everyone, if you do want to make contact with me, my email is behavioralhealthintegration121@gmail.com. I also have a LinkedIn account and my website is behavioralhealthintegration.org. I'll make sure I put that in the show notes. I also want to inform everyone that there is a great new device out there called Calmigo. It's a breathing device meant to control and manage your breathing rates and the depth of your breathing as you inhale and exhale to again help relieve any type of anxiety and stress-like symptoms. And if you do put the BHI podcast into the promo code, you get $30 off this amazing device. It is a once-in-a-lifetime deal and you will not be disappointed. And for next week, for all those interested in psychedelic assisted therapy, I have a gentleman named Jared that will be on the show. Jared Reinhardt is a lead integration coach at the Heroic Hearts Project regarding veterans and psychedelic assisted therapy. That is truly a must-see episode. And until next time, thank you everyone and have a good day. Bye.